Earlier in the session, this has nothing to do with, well, not nothing to do with Star Formation. It's not directly related to Star Formation, but there was a question that was raised yesterday about the relative locations of all the various clouds near around Sagittarius A star. So during one of the coffee breaks, we made a stab at it. So this is Orion deck of what you see when you actually take a map. You see Sagittarius A star in the center of Sagittarius A west. You see Sagittarius A east, kind of, you know, with its centroid to the east of Sagittarius A west, but it actually goes around the side. You see the 51, the plus 50 kilometer second cloud up here to the northeast and to the southwest, 20 kilometer second per cloud. And we had people with all, various different kinds of data, and this is more, we couldn't come to agreement on exactly how you would draw it if you could look at the other way. We decided what was in front and what was behind. So that what's that we're taking Sagittarius A star and Sagittarius A to be in the plane of the sky together, which was but there were a bunch of arguments made in that direction yesterday. Anyways, that the plus 50 cloud is plus 50 cloud is in front of Sagittarius A east, but that only somewhat, very, that they're actually quite close and physically interacting. This, the plus 20 cloud is also in front of Sagittarius A east, but seems to be farther out of closer to the observer than the plus 50 cloud. It's not interacting as much. And that while Sagittarius A east seems to be primarily behind Sagittarius A west, it is also interacting with Sagittarius A west. So these, in fact, part of the reasons why it's hard to decide what's in front and what's in back, so everything is in fact very close on the plane of the sky. That, you know, you say, okay, so this distance is like 3 parsecs and this distance is some parsecs. But the line of sight distances we're talking about, front, behind, are similar to the size of the clouds in question. So it's a little complicated to say this is the front, this is the back. Anyway, so I decided. And I throw this out in the spirit of stimulating more discussion for tomorrow or some other time, not in this session today, because it's not, we're talking about Star Formation today, but that if people have violent disagreements with the placement of all these clouds, they should come and present their argument to me, and I will do a revised picture at some point. But
can we comment on that now?
Can you comment on it right now? Yeah, sure, go ahead.
But one fly in the ointment with the picture you drew, and I sort of agree with that picture, but the 20 and 50 kilometer per second clouds show very little velocity gradient across their length, and yet their extent is a factor of 2 or 3 greater than the projected distance between those clouds and Sagittarius A star. And if they were anywhere near Sagittarius A star, then one should expect a strong velocity
rotation
gradients, because these would reflect rotation given their extent in the sky. So that raises a red flag as to where along the line of sight these might lie.
Somebody over there had OH data, and actually they did see a gradient as you move from plus 50, plus 40, plus 30, as you came across the plus 50 cloud. But I'm not the expert on this. So I just sort of threw that out for people to think about, and maybe more of the people who do the observations can get together and, you know, like you said, you know, challenge it and see if we can come up with a better idea of the overall geometry of the galactic center, or at least the central few parsecs. But in terms of star formation, sorry, I have terrible handwriting. several questions came to mind while the sessions were going on, and I'm just going to list some of them, and but of course the discussion can go wherever it likes. One is the question is star formation in a series of bursts, or is it continuous? We know that we currently have a burst of star formation in that 5 to 8 million years old, and the central cluster, there's a burst that's a few million years old in the arches, and a little bit older than that in the quintuplet. When you try and look at the star formation history over giga years, and you say it's continuous, does it have to be absolutely flat, or can it, like, you know, go like this, and you average over 100 million years, and you've got maybe, you know, 20 bursts that are 5 million years apart. So that was one thing that came to mind. Another thing that came to mind was, obviously that's coming up with two camps, metallicity, which is high or solar. Another thing that keeps nagging at me, that we couldn't find anyone to give a talk on this, and so far it seems impossible to, no one's come up with a decent way of probing this, but the very youngest star cluster in the galactic center is Sagittarius B2. And apparently there's no K counterparts to its deepest people have searched so far. But we know from radio that there's compact H2 regions there. There's masers indicating young solar objects. And the compact H2 regions indicate the formation of O stars. So, Mark, I think you said there were 70 H2 regions, so I mean 70 O stars. So, is there any observational technique that we as a group can come up with to get at studying the star formation of Sagittarius B2, given that it's got 300 magnitudes of extinction in front of it, visual extinction, which makes, you know, 30 magnitudes of K, and that makes it awfully hard to detect. I mean, I just made that number up, but it's obviously much more red than the rest of the galactic center. Another question is that there's this thing about how the clusters are getting tidally disrupted. Presumably, once the clusters get disrupted, their stars don't, like, vanish. And one would like to actually find young stars that have been perhaps disrupted from their cluster, but now are off on their own, but us to still be able to, you know, study them and see if we actually have other. I mean, Don said that he'd done narrowband surveys, and other people had too, saying that, well, there's not a whole lot of field stars that are helium emission line stars, but there's other manifestations of massive star formation, like the young supergiants and O stars, which are harder to see than the emission line stars. Can we find the stars that used to be in a cluster, but now they're tidally disrupted and spread through things? Another thing that's been nagging at me for years is that we have these quintuplet sources, and we have a few other sources like them, like the northern arm sources in Sagittarius A West. And as Dawn eloquently put them, it's a 1,000-degree dust ball. But they're supposed to be, people keep saying that these are dusty Wolf-Rayet stars. And if so, is there any way we can prove that? Is there any wavelength that we can look at that will get through the dust and we'll find a spectral feature that will confirm that these are in fact WC stars? And let's see, what else did I come up with? We've got metallicity discrepancies, we've got burst versus continuous discrepancies, we've got no information on Sagittarius B2. Oh, someone gave a number of 1 supernova per 10^4 years. Is that enough to support the amount of X-ray gas we see in the galactic center? Or do we need more, or do we have too many supernovae? And the last, which came out actually of another discussion, is pressure equilibrium. We know the three-phase model of the interstellar medium, that there's equilibrium points that correspond to the cold neutral medium, the warm neutral ionized medium, and the hot ionized medium. And we keep saying the pressure is higher, the temperatures are higher, the densities are higher in the galactic center, which means that the phases, hot, warm, and cold, should all be shifting to different places on a pressure temperature diagram. And has anyone worked out the equilibrium that would establish how these all things can be, you know, how you can get a stable situation with the heating and cooling mechanisms present in the galactic center? Anyways, with that, those are the ideas that I had, and so I'm just going to kind of open it up for discussion at this point. Angela?
Actually, by the time of the disruptive cluster, there actually is one star that was in a paper that has not read by a lot of people, but it's basically down south of the galactic center of the Arches cluster, right in front of that G0.09.4 region. And I went back and got a second spectra finally this last summer, and it looks very similar. It looks very, and it looks very, very similar to the rest of the cluster stars. So it does look like perhaps at least one hot massive star has been stripped from the Arches cluster.
Okay.
So I haven't finished, obviously. I took the data too, so.
Right. So we have
some work where I see occasionally potential candidates down in that region between Sagittarius West and the Arches cluster. So there are some sources in there which may be individual hot stars. And then I would actually argue that the quintuplet cluster is a cluster that's in the process of trying to make time disruptive because it is so much more spread out than the Arches cluster, because Don sees stars almost all the way up to the sickle that might be associated with the quintuplet cluster. So I would argue that the quintuplet cluster is in the process of being time disruptive.
Okay.
Don?
I just wanted to add that there are 2 stars that have bracket gamma emission but are otherwise very cool, as if they're dust and shrouded, but there is some ionizing flux, and they're 5 arc minutes south of the quintuplet. So it's very clear that they're far beyond the boundary of the quintuplet and that they're in the field. They're in Ian Glass's list of bright infrared sources within 1 degree. I went and looked at some of those. So there are a few scattered around.
Okay. So there's some work, some work basically serendipitously at some level of finding some of the hot massive stars that have been tidally stripped from clusters,
but one thing I wanted to add about your question of sources other than emission line sources.
Right.
So I calculated the number of red supergiants, the steady state number of red supergiants. Assuming Arches quintuplet central clusters are formed every 10 megayears.
Yeah.
And the steady state is a few hundred.
A few hundred.
So my question to you is, have you found a few hundred red supergiants?
We haven't, but we would love to find them. That's kind of why I'm listening.
but I'm thinking they're not there.
I'm thinking no one's done the work.
In the central, say, 30 parsecs.
No, because, I mean, it took us, 3 years of observing every galactic center season to do 70 spectra of galactic center stars in the central 5 parsecs. The work that Bob Lund did with really cool stars and star formation history. And we've got 3 seasons to do 70 stars. Now, if you just take all the stars that have the right colors and are bright enough to be in supergiants and then go bang, bang, bang trying to observe them all, you're going to get a mix of M supergiants, AGV stars, and background things, or foreground things if you don't get the red name quite right. And it's gonna take you a very long time. You're gonna have to go sort through a lot of chaff before you get to the wheat of 300 and supergiants. And as much as I would love to do this, I think doing it one by one is gonna take a long time. So I think this may be a problem that's going to await imaging spectroscopy of some sort. Yes?
So rotation time period is so short, so I expect you all mix them in. Once the clusters are dissolved, so the stars will mix everywhere in the orbit.
Right.
Then you just need to sample one area then to see how many this kind of star, massive stars might have, and you can extrapolate
pretty
much.
That's true, right? You don't need to find them all.
You
didn't just need to find some. So, Jean-Pierre.
What I'm trying to suggest is that, so IRS-13E, so is the remnant core of a category of destructive cluster.
Right.
Gave birth to the one which is spread, what you call the helium star. Is that? And there, it's what I've shown that it is 13E, so we see sample on all the odd star because we see several O star and dwarf Rigel stars. And what is inside just at the core, maybe it was misleading so to use the term of a unistellar object because actually it's just very, something very red. But not knowing, so it's probably so wrong to say pick about Jupiter object because sure it's a very it's something which should be from the E2 star, which is a rough radius, so it should be something 5 billion years old, something like that. And of course Jupiter object is too long. So it's why it's probably more some other old type, something which is a lot of mass loss, which means why is it so much red. An object just there, which is three, that should be probably for a category of restricted cluster.
I mean, I think that at least in terms of doing infrared work on searching for young massive stars, that the tendency in the last decade has been to go to higher and higher spatial resolution. I mean, it used to be IRS-16 was a source. There was IRS-16, and there was IRS-7, there was IRS-3. You know, IRS-16 was one source. And then hiring, as arrays came online, people were able to actually say, oh, wait, maybe there's three sources, IRS-16, north, middle, and south. And then it became, oh, well, maybe there's 10 sources. And as the resolution goes up and up, more and more sources are found. And then you find all the little tiny stars that are around Sagittarius A star that have the high proper motion. And we've in the last decade a lot of us have been working kind of at going to higher and higher angular resolution to get more details on the three really major clusters that we know of. And I guess what I'm thinking is maybe that there's also a niche in this work for going outwards, for not like doing, you know, for I mean, you know, one set of people go and do higher and higher angle resolution and try and pick out more and more fine details and you know separate one star with weird characteristics into a double star with normal characteristics and things like that. But there's also a place for looking at the whole central 30 or 100 parsecs and saying, okay, where are the massive stars? Where are the old stars? Where, you know, what is the whole thing look like in terms of star formation? And that's going to be a tough task because it's going to take a lot. I mean, you have to think about how do you do a good design and study for something like that, because you can't go and measure all the stars in the galactic center, get spectra and then classify and put them on the H-ray diagram. There's just too many. Yeah.
I don't know. My question may make sense or not, but hearing the many talks, I am just wondering, there are many objects which are relatively short lifetimes, but in the history of the galaxy, this is just one moment, So I'm just wondering, these phenomena are all temporary or a special phase of the galactic evolution, or there are any evolutionary trend of the, I don't know the answer, of course, but I'd like to hear some comment or suggestion.
Well, we have, as far as I know, we have three opinions on that. Mark Morris and Dean Sarabin wrote a paper in 1996 saying that they thought the star formation of Galactic Center was essentially continuous, but they didn't rule out the possibility of there being little peaks of star bursting in the middle of that. Don Feiger has modeled his data with a where you go, where he has actually detected the main sequence in some, it was in the Arches cluster?
Random fields around.
Random fields, okay. Where he finds his best fit is to assume continuous star formation and no bursting at a particular time. And then there's the work from Bob Long, where there's kind of like currently a peak in the star formation history, and then it's kind of quiet. And a gig a year ago, there was another peak in the star formation activity, and then there's like nothing until you get to like 15, a Hubble time, and then it's a little bit higher again. Is that more or less how that diagram goes?
But I would caution against describing any of these in terms of bursts or not bursts, because obviously burst can go off and it's so short-lived that, and you don't have any kind of age resolution over a long time scale.
That's right.
We're just talking about the average star formation rate at a given time.
Yeah, I mean that's what I meant about saying that, you say it's constant over the year, but is that like spiky in that period, or is it smooth?
Every star.
Right, exactly. Yes, question.
Yeah, I'm not sure about your definition of starburst here. Based on two clusters?
Great.
Small statistics.
In the OHR stars, you can see a peak of expansion velocities. And I think that really pinpoints a burst some giga years ago. But the problem is that your time resolution is not good enough. So whether you have continuous or burst, it all depends on your time resolution. So close by, in the last 100 million years, we have 5 million years time resolution. But if you go further than that, it all blends together. And it's very difficult to say this is burst. Because 100 million years on a time scale of 3 giga years is nothing.
So what about the current star burst? I'm not sure that's the burst. The two clusters?
Three.
So the middle, the gas center cluster, I'm not sure about that. Actually, that's, I have a question.
Well, I guess I should distinguish between, I don't think anyone in another galaxy looking at the Milky Way would call us a starburst galaxy, okay? That we would just be an ordinary, star-forming galaxy of our appropriate spectral type or Hubble type, and that there wouldn't be anything special about us. We wouldn't be an AGN. We wouldn't be a starburst galaxy. We would just be an ordinary spiral. And the issue of whether we're having bursts or not bursts is that we've kind of gotten that what mode of thinking, because we have these three localized places where basically a third of the Wolf Rayet stars in the entire galaxy have formed in three localized places within 30 parsecs of the center of the galaxy. That seems anomalous. And so we say, okay, we have a little three cases where there's been a little, jump in the star formation rate with very high density that have formed a whole bunch of O stars that have evolved to Wolf Rayet stars that account for more Wolf Rayet stars than, well, not more, but account for a significant chunk of the total Wolf Rayet stars known in our galaxy. That seems like a weird, slightly weird phenomenon. That's kind of what drives the word burst, but it's not starburst in the sense like we just collided with Magellanic clouds and all of a sudden the entire disk has gone bang and formed, that our star formation rate's gone up by a factor of 200, whatever.
I'd like to address SAGB too, because if I remember right, that is the largest star formation region in our galaxy.
I wouldn't be surprised, and so little known about it.
And it also has the viscosity, optical depth in the submillimeters thick, I believe, 350 microns. So your AB of 300 is exactly right. You can't see through there at 10 microns.
Is there any way, has anyone tried looking, I mean, obviously there's radio emission gets through the dust, and it is possible to tell the difference between an ultra-contact H2 region, I believe, and a stellar wind by the spatial distribution.
Yeah, I'm sure it's no.
Has anyone done VLBI or something on this?
No, you can't do them at VLBI, but with the VLA and high resolution, they're all compact H2 regions with extremely large emission measures. 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 9th. They're optically thick. Some of them are even at 1 centimeter. Mark Reed has done a census of, there must be 100 H2O lasers there, probably, their latest survey.
And what does it say? It's less than 10 to the 6th star or something. That's even younger.
Oh, yeah.
It's
right.
The most massive star formation even in the galaxy.
Yes, and we talk about the ones that we can see, at least in the infrared and radio, that are easy, in X-rays that are easy to pick out, like arches and clusters and the central cluster. But Sagittarius B2, if you're correct that is the largest star forming region, then essentially that somebody should be paying a lot of attention to that, doing a comparison between the radio characteristics of that versus the arches or the.
What about Sag B1? Is it?
Is there a Sagittarius B1? There must be, but.
We work on it. But what about in the infrared? Is it also dead?
I don't know.
Angela, you've been trying to raise your hand.
What I'm trying to think was, have this X-ray people looked at, because we've seen some spectacular new information in the X-ray. Is there a way to use the X-ray? I mean, if you can find X-ray gas.
No, I know why that.
The X-ray
should be able to see through this very heavy.
And what can that tell us?
Well, yeah, I was thinking about that. It depends upon, first of all, what do you think the sort of normal right now X-ray luminosity of the stars is within some range? I don't know what the number is. But if you then say, okay, you want a factor of 200 starbursts, and then you have to say how long, one paper I can think of that sort of can be used to address this is Cranford and Sunyaya looked at scattering off molecular clouds and gas through our galaxy to try and put a limit on how bright could Sagittarius A star have been in the last 140,000 years or so. Forget that it's Sagittarius A star, instead replace that with the starburst. And now they do several different models because you have to worry about both the intensity and the duration. But you might be able to look at their plots if you had some estimate of what is within some region our total X-ray luminosity from the stars and how much of an increase are you expecting. You might be able to look at that paper and get some idea.
But we've seen the X-ray emission from the Arches cluster itself. Can't we look at Sag B2 to see if we see something similar in Sag B2
Good
in the X-ray?
We
heard you talk yesterday.
And the answer was?
X-ray as well.
Yeah.
I forgot. That's what I was trying to get at.
Right. If you're talking about 100 magnitudes of extinction.
Okay. So that's going to screw up the X-ray anyway.
It's out of the chamber.
Yeah.
Okay. You need a hard X-ray.
We already know by Chandra observation, we already know that young IMA star X-ray emitter is luminosity 10 to the 31 to the 32. And we actually get X-ray emission from the center of Sag B2, which is the place of ultra compact complex. And the luminosity and temperature is consistent with the other young IMA star.
So what is the
consistent
that they've been talking about? Is.
Yeah.
The column density, are you getting
Column density? Yeah, column density is if we convert the AV, it's 200 or 300.
For
so it is 10, 4 times 10 to the, 5 times 10 to the 23rd.
So it's a right
extension.
Yeah.
But in hard density, it can be generated. About 4 kV, we can see.
12 kV. What instrument is this?
Chandra.
Chandra, 12 kV.
4.
four. Okay. About okay.
But also, you know, X-ray properties of clusters change, evolve with the age of clusters. Now, so very young clusters like ZFE2 will be totally different from Arches clusters. You should not really compare, I mean, clusters at different ages. They are totally different processes.
Well, does anyone have any ideas? I'm going to change topics unless anybody else has anything to add. Does anyone have any clue how we can verify that the quintuplet plus sources and similar sources are in fact carbon-rich Wolf-Rayet stars that have embedded themselves in so much dust you can see only the dust, that the dusty WC stars? I mean, is there any wavelength that can penetrate the envelope and actually see some emission? That means, can radio emission go in there and see the stellar winds? Yeah.
Gene, is Gene Sharker?
Yeah.
Gene.
Yeah.
It looks like
you
actually did have signature of it.
Not the photosphere, though.
No, that was in the photosphere, but it looks like you... I mean, the point is we want to be able to classify them as WC stars.
Right.
Is there something we can use? It looked like you almost had something there.
And it's kind of circumstantial evidence that we see this absorption at 6.2 microns that we don't see in just the regular diffuse interstellar medium.
But I mean, that's a lead. We haven't
leads
here before.
So that says that they're whatever the objects are carbon rich, and that actually is, because 6.2 is the CC
structure aromatics, right? So you see those in the dusty WC stars that are known to be dusty WC stars, and in the quintuplet sources.
Okay.
So that's
maybe, so maybe if we went to higher resolution of 6.2, then there might be more information.
I don't know if structure within that band.
I don't know. Hey, just.
But
I mean, that's the only thing I've ever seen.
You're asking about the photosphere, and it's a question of what kind of evidence you want to see. So Gene was talking about evidence from the circumstellar material.
Mm-hmm.
That's relevant. That's evidence.
That's
you mentioned the photosphere, but that's not where the lines are seen.
Okay,
Wolf-Rayet stars, it's in the, well, do you need the wind? Or see, the question is, what evidence do you really want? As far as the wind goes,
Cornelia.
Well, from the photosphere, the wind, or the dust shell? Okay. Well, we have something, 6.2 microns. Cornelia detected it with the VLA and found a few 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per year mass loss, which is right in line with the WCL. And there was a Chandra detection. So we have three new pieces of evidence.
Okay,
that
so that's pretty much nailed it.
And the mass loss rate is, that's a very extreme mass loss rate compared to the other radio sources we've detected for other stars that aren't WC stars.
So this one is a yes because we have...
Well, it's a whole bunch of...
6.2 micron, we have X-rays, and we have radio from the winds.
But it's a whole bunch of little pieces of evidence that aren't usually used to classify.
Well, that's the point of this
conference.
That's the point of this conference, though, to bring together lots of people at different wavelengths that generally don't talk to each other and actually put all those pieces of the puzzle together.
Normally, the evidence is the wind signatures in the optical, and we're just not going to do that.
We can't do any of that in the optics center. We can't do any optical classification. Yes.
I should mention that this is sort of the same situation that I have with the Northern Arm sources. So we don't see photosphere emissions. They're all featured in the K-band. And in my talk on Friday, I talk about how I use the fact that they're resolved at 2.2 microns to show that they must be very windy, on the order of what's expected for the WCLs. So again, yes, it'd be nice to get some photosphere emissions on these guys, but it's really difficult.
However, we looked at the quintuplet sources and didn't see them extended.
They're not extended.
So they are different.
Yes,
than the northern arm sources in terms of their 2 microns.
But they're extended at 10 microns.
Yes.
I think Susan saw that.
8.7.
Yeah,
there's a Benetti et al. Paper with power imaging that they're on our second resolution. And there's huge resolved dust shells.
Yeah, like 1,000 AU.
I don't.
It's not around all of them. There's one that we're not all resources.
Fights between Santa Monica and Pasadena.
And okay. Santa Monica.
Tom.
What about IRIS 3? It's very close, so I'm plenty of the sky is like centered. Is it an more extreme example of this phenomenon? I think it's probably very hard to observe in some of these identifying characteristics because it's in the middle of this energetic region.
We'll talk about this definitely more on Friday, but I think 3 is probably like a quintuplet proper number, but it's not embedded in the northern arm, so it's more like a quintuplet proper.
It also has a very strong silicon feature, and I do not believe these quintuplets have. You know, they just have the interstellar silicate absorption, whereas IRS 3 has a much deeper silicate absorption feature than any of the other.
So it could be an oxygen-rich and all-star.
Right.
Okay, well, it's actually 5:30 and time to quit.